Mr. Watson, Reel 5. Now, you were telling me a story about how the German air raid, and how the last point you made was that the aircraft was shooting down the balloons, or shooting at the balloons,
yeah,
as they passed up the Humber.
They obviously were going to come and bomb the shipping in the Humber, and this was a preparatory thing for the night, I suppose. But anyway, now in front of where I was on guard there in the early hours of the morning, and there was a machine gun, a Vickers gas operated machine gun with a pile of ammunition on it. And I was standing there, and I heard the noise in the office behind me. This was the old station commander's place, station master's office of the siding. And it was one of the balloon barge members calling from the estuary to say that a Ju-88 was shooting at the balloons. And so I went out. And our standing orders were that we had to report anything to this telephone number, which was the home number of the flight lieutenant who was in charge of the auxiliary squadron running the balloons. He lived at home, ran his business as a paint retailer, and was paid rations and so on as an auxiliary. And he had his son-in-law as his deputy, who was a flying officer. And they recruited their auxiliary balloon workers from the auxiliaries who were members, usually, of the company. So they employed their own employees as auxiliaries, RAF auxiliaries. And they all drew rations.
Hang on, you're losing a bit. Keep, you were about to open fire, I think.
Oh, yes. So things were pressing because the aircraft was getting louder and louder and nearer. I could hear it in the distance. And I'd seen one balloon flare up way out at the estuary. So I tried to get through on the telephone and couldn't get through. Probably they were in bed asleep or something. Must have been, because it was early morning. It was nice, very early. And so I dashed out, and when the aircraft came a bit closer, I opened fire on it. And he decided to sheer off and buzz off, which he did. Nothing happened until the officer came in the morning. Usually come in about 8:30, and demanded to know. He'd been told about this incident from some of the barge keepers. You know, the blokes out with the balloons on the barge. He'd been talking to them, and he demanded to know why he hadn't been told. He was the officer in charge, and he should know what's going on. And I suppose he's a bit popped that he didn't know about it. Anyway, he says, the orders clearly stay here. You must support any enemy aircraft or anything, any sign of the enemy, before taking action, report it to this telephone number. He says, you disobeyed an order.
Did you tell him you'd tried to?
Oh, yes. He says, that's no excuse. You didn't. Doesn't matter how much you tried, you didn't succeed. You say you tried. I don't know whether you did or not. But there we are. So, I was duly 252. That's the, I don't know if you know that, but that's the
Can charge sheet. Can you explain it?
252 is the formal charge sheet for disobeying a standing order. And here we have your signature on that standing order saying that you obey the standing orders. You know, when you went to the unit, you had a, you shan't do this, you shan't smoke on duty, you won't sign it. And then they've got you called if you, you signed it. So the 252, Corporal Nibbett, was his name? Was it Nibbett, I think, something like that. He gave me, he said, 252, I'm in charge of you. Yeah, that's it. See, you don't abscond. As if I could
What punishment did they give you?
Oh, confined to camp, which didn't limit too much, but I was going out with a girl from Hull, and that sort of cramped my style.
Now, was there anything else happened while you were at Hull before we go back to Calshot? Because this was a bit of a...
Anything happened. I told you about the sunken boat, didn't I? Launch that was
yes.
Strung up. And
how long were you at Hull? You got there in about September. How many months were you there?
I would think about 6-7 months, something like that.
So through into 1941, in about March.
Yeah.
So you'd go to Calshot around about March.
Yeah. 1941. Yeah, about that. Give or take a month, approximately.
And how long were you at Calshot? Because we've already dealt with Calshot.
I think I'd have only been there about a month or 6 weeks. Because it was how, you know, you weren't doing coursework all the time. You were sort of in between. You were doing fatigues and this, that, and the other.
So what was your next post after Calshot then?
No.
Is this when you went out to North Africa?
Yes, but I went posted from there to Cromarty because they asked us where we wanted to go.
And what unit was it at Cromarty?
It is now. I think I have a. It's a four-figure, 11 something or other. It was Motorboat Section, Cromarty, Rosshire. That's just across the bay here, right across opposite Findon, right out there. And they had an air sea rescue launch and seaplane tender. That's a twin engine job that I drove. And I was promoted to corporal, I think, there.
What difference did that make, being promoted to corporal?
Well, because I had passed the course at Calshot, the second, there was two courses, and you sort of went from one into the other, saved you sending you back to unit and back, come back again. In other words, you did the basic sort of Morse code and semaphore and this sort of stuff. And then you did the other bit, which entitled you to become a coxswain. And that a corporal followed. And the corporal bit was really, I suppose, just so that you had the authority in the boat to chuck anybody off it or order your crew about, because you had a wireless operator.
Well, tell me, which boat were you in? You were in the launch?
No. They had an establishment at Cromarty of an air sea rescue launch, which was a big launch, twin Rolls Royce motors, a thing that really thrummed along. They had 30 knot. And they also had the seaplane tenders, which was a thing I was.
So you were on the seaplane tender, sorry?
I was on the seaplane tender.
So what was your job?
As coxswain of the sea. And on it, I had a wireless operator and two crewmen, one of whom was the gunner, because in the rear part of it, it had an open deck at the back with two diesel engines, and in the middle, it had a tripod and a Vickers machine gun with a pan of ammunition on top. So, the wireless operator was inside, he got his instructions if, for example, an airplane at Cromarty, they had seaplanes. If one crashed, we were there, out ready to shoot her. And at night time, we towed out little dinghy things, little boats. And on them was a mast and a battery, and this shone a light, a little bulb of light. And we laid them along into the wind. So we got the wind, dropped them off. They had a rope and an anchor, and they dropped them off so that the Sunderlands could land on the left-hand side into wind and know where they were.
So you sort of lay out landing on...
Exactly. We laid out a flare path, but only one side of it. See, you didn't need the other side because it was sea. You're doing it in the water, unlimited, you could go off to the left. And you had to go along this to make sure that there wasn't... Now, this was very important in Africa.
We'll come back to it then, yeah. Mm. That was part of the job you were doing at Cromarty as well.
Yeah, yeah. It's called laying a flare path into wind.
And what about... what other jobs did you have?
Towing aircraft. For example, if an aircraft... there was a slipway, concrete slipway, on an island just opposite Oban, and we used to tow them from the buoy, and because it was difficult taxiing through the area because of the other aircraft, we would tow them, and the biggest tow, because they were windborne, the tail of the aircraft, and see, pulling out that way, and you'd be trying to get the engines going. So you had to work both engines, and two of them, and to the slip, and there's chaps in chest high waders came out, got the floats, and they put wheels under the floats and the body of the machine, you know, the boat shape, and had a wire to a winch, and towed them up the slip for servicing or repairs.
Anything else you had to do?
Ferry people to and from. In fact, there's a photograph of me. I only recognised it a few years ago when my daughter gave me a booklet. And I remember the instance of them taking this picture. I was driving one of these dinghies at the time. That was a small boat with a single engine. And this was at Oban. I was taking out a representative of some news organisation, Pathy News. And I just recognised because I happened to see a picture in this booklet here.
So you would ferry out anybody who needed to go out?
Anybody who needed. Sometimes the captain or the cook or whoever was going out to the boat, the ammunition going out. We had bomb scows. Bomb scows were flat steel with two petrol engines, twin engines, and you sat between them, throttles. And on these, they took out depth charges or bombs. They were flat bottom, about this width, half the width of this room, and metal sides, blunt nose, just like a barge, but small, two powerful little Ford engines. And we used to take them, ammunition and any heavy gear.
So they weren't towed, they were self-propelled?
They were self-propelled, two lovely engines. And when I was in Africa, I took them up the River Gambia.
I'll come back there. So you had you had them at Cromarty as well?
Yes. Yes, you always had to have them because there's nothing else could take these heavy articles out to the flying boats.
Anything else yet that you did at Cromarty before we move on?
I once was sent out to take a bloke from a convoy that was going up the North Sea. See, they went up the North Sea and came round the top of Scotland to get out into the Atlantic. And it was a bit dangerous because the U-boats concentrated between Norway and the Shetlands to stop them. So I was sent out to take a sick seaman from one of the, it was a phone boat anyway, Anyway, I had to go along. Now, a destroyer, because it was such a big ship, a convoy escort destroyer went alongside and took this bloke from this big cargo ship, they lowered on the stretcher onto the destroyer. And the destroyer took him away and put him into a dinghy. She lowered him over the side into one of these big dinghies, you know, they have life-saving rafts. Because I couldn't get, there was quite a sea running, and I had been smashed against the destroyer, you see. So they put him into that, and they let it out on a rope, and I came up behind, and the crew boys got him into the thing, the stretcher. They lifted it, laid it on the engine covers, and then took it off and put it into the cabin. So that was about the only interesting thing that happened.
How long were you at Cromarty? You got there, well, we're not sure of any of these dates, but you know, you thought around about something like May 41, perhaps.
I was there over Christmas.
So you were there about 6 months, 7 months?
Yes, 6 months or so.
The thing is that, from what we just discussed off tape, essentially you've no idea what dates of any of this, and you're a bit shaky on the order, because it turns out you actually went to Africa before you went to Cromarty.
Yes, Cromarty was my posting after I got back.
So where did you go? Was it Africa you were sent out to, Ghana, that you were sent out to from Calshot?
I have to think about this.
So we think you were posted to Ghana from there. So could you tell us about...
Gambia.
Could you tell us something about how you got that posting?
I 204 Squadron. 204 Squadron was being sent out to open up a flying boat base to cover the Northwest Atlantic and the estuary of the Gambia River. So they were assembling the backup to the Sunderland Squadron to send it out to Gambia. And a lot of the technical people were posted to this station. But they had to go out by troop ship and they had to report to a troop ship at Greenock. Somewhere I've got the name of the troop ship. And that's why we all assembled in Catholic Girls' School accommodation. And we were accommodated at Greenock, awaiting for this troop ship to pick us up. I now don't remember the name of it, I think. Jumana, there's two. Jumana was the one that, when we arrived at Freetown, and the Orjuna was the one that took us out there, we transshipped.
Now, what do you remember about the voyage out?
Well, I had an extremely uncomfortable time because I had stomach ache. And our hammocks were slung above the tables and we slept in hammocks. And throughout the voyage I was having, the latter stage of the voyage took about 21 days, I think, I was having a terrible stomach ache. And a friend of mine, who was an insurance agent in peacetime, Stevenson, he was in the next hammock to me. We were above the tables. You stood on the table to get into your hammock. And your kit was on racks above. And Steve says, I'll go up to the sick quarters and see if we can get something for you. He went up to sick quarters, and by this time we're just about entering the river. And he said, went up there, and back came an orderly, and he said, oh, you've got some tummy ache, we'll give you some magnesium. So I got that, didn't do any good. By this time, we're in the harbour, and the anchor's down. We're there. And so my stomach was so terrible, and Steve said, you better go sick. Now, to go sick, you had to be shaved. You had to be, in your kit. There would be no question of a doctor coming down to see you. We had a medical officer on board. Harvey was his name. And so I was climbing up these ladders out of where the tube deck was, holding my stomach, and sort of doubled up, going along there, and I got to the sick bay, sick attendant, and he said, you haven't shaved. He says, I'll give you a razor. He says, you've got to be shaved to see the MO. And here's me doubled over with pain in this bowl, trying to shave myself. And then went into the doctor, appendicitis. So he then got the first mate to the tube ship to arrange a stretcher and lower me over the side, and I was taken ashore on a boat that was using until the RAF launches were there. I was taken ashore on this motorboat. And I was then a military ambulance driven by a black driver, when you know what they're like, by, to a field hospital at Cape St. Mary in the Gambia, which is about, I think, about 8 miles from the capital. It was a bumpy road, and I was rattling about on a tight stretcher, and it was a black driver, and it was the most uncomfortable journey I've ever had. I got there, and I was wheeled in, and I remember to this tent and this army surgeon, and he was like a butcher, hairy arms, stripped because it was hot, and a florid face, I can remember him there, and got me on there. Oh, I had to have an enema first, and oh God, that was agony. And because I was so doubled up, and anyway, they got me on there, plugged me into this anaesthetic, and I remember the reflected lights that they had above the, I was looking up into, were flattened petrol cans. You know, with they had shiny insides and were camouflage paint outsides, and they had used these to shine the lights down on me. I remember looking up with these and thought, what a good idea, and was operated on. And the odd thing, I remember, of course, there's mosquitoes everywhere there. I remember coming to two from this penicillin anaesthetic, and looking through, and there was a black boy there, and he had big white eyes, and I thought, my God, I'm in hell. It was pitch dark. And he said, that daughter says, are you better, Martha? He says. And the surgeon said, he came round the next day and said, there's a close call there. He says, who's your doctor? And I told him, this is how I'm going to have a word with him. And he says, this idea of an assistant orderly prescribing medicine is just not on. So I reckon he gave this ship's doctor a hell of a racket.
How long were you ashore at the hospital?
About 3 weeks altogether. I was wondering about, for a week.
Now, when you went to this was 204 Squadron, and you were attached to them. What were you actually called? Were you the Air Sea Rescue, or did you have a number? Marine Section Air Sea Rescue.
We weren't called the Air Sea Rescue, just the Marine Section, because as well as the rescue, we did the service, taking the bombs out and the crews out to the aircraft.
So it's just Marine Section 204?
Marine Section included the Air Sea Rescue element always.
And that was part of 204 Squadron, or
204, attached to? 204 Squadron. And the place was Bathurst.
How do you spell that?
B-A-T-H, Bathurst. That was after Lord Bathurst discovered the place.
And that was the name of the flying boat base?
That's it.
And the Gambia River estuary.
Gambia River, yes. 204 Squadron.
And tell us a bit about your work out there.
Well,
I mean, you've told us some about Cromarty, which I know came afterward, tell us what it was like, typical day.
Well, of course, the climate was, as you know, quite hot, and mosquitoes were rife. And so malaria was a big thing, so you took malaria tablets.
Mepicrin,
yellow. Dandy yellow, I think, after that. But before that, now this is interesting, while we were on the ship, we didn't have Mepicrin, and they were preparing us for this mosquitoes, and you got liquid quinine. And you got it in the same mug as you drank your tea. So your tea wasn't terribly palatable. But a bloke came round with a big demijohn of quinine and a tablespoon. And he held your mug out and he poured some, sometimes not very accurately, and he tipped it in and then you drank it. And the chap in charge of the table, of your troop table, he had to see that everyone drank the quinine. And then after the quinine, when we got ashore, we got Mepicrin, which is a big advantage.
Were there any other anti-malaria precautions? I mean, did you have nets?
Yes. Because I remember seeing this, are you there, Martha, and this big, what is it? They were the orderlies, they did all the dead.
Did you have nets and mosquito nets?
Yes.
All around your berth?
Yeah.
Where were you actually living?
In huts.
Ashore?
Yes.
And what were the huts like?
They were Nissen huts with thatch on them. The thatch was really to take some of the heat there, because a Nissen hut, corrugated iron, would become impossible to live in. And the floor was cement. We had a tap outside for water, because you didn't drink any of the water that was available there. Because the whole town and base was built on a sandbank in a mangrove swamp. And it was not unusual to see the water snakes, because the swamps came right, the whole estuary was mud and mangroves. And I have a photograph of a snake skin. Us holding the snake skin about from here to that door there.
6-8 foot.
And this was one of they used to trap and kill them, you see, and bring them in and sell them to the troops.
Were they dangerous, these snakes? Or?
Oh, that was a boa constrictor, you see. And there was an awful lot of small snakes. Which inhabited they looked like twigs in the mangroves, And when a bird came down near them, they grabbed it, you see. And we used to...